Ever been watching a legal drama and seen a witness completely flip their story on the stand? It's TV gold, right?
Oh, absolutely.
But it's also a real head-scratcher in the courtroom. Today, we're plunging into a Massachusetts case, Commonwealth v. Day from 1984, that fundamentally reshaped how those moments are handled in court.
That's right.
Now, as a law student, you're building your foundation in evidence and trial procedure. Think of this deep dive into Day as adding a crucial layer to that understanding, specifically around prior inconsistent statements, how witness identifications are treated, and, that constant tug of war between finding the truth and safeguarding a defendant's rights. This isn't just dusty case law, it's a bedrock decision that still echoes in Massachusetts courtrooms today.
Yeah, it really is. And what's particularly interesting about Day is how a specific set of facts led to a really significant evolution in Massachusetts evidence rules.
Right.
So our goal in this deep dive is to unpack the layers of this Supreme Judicial Court opinion, pull out the essential insights, and really connect it to what you're learning and, well, what you'll be doing in your legal career.
Okay.
We'll be looking at what actually happened, the legal arguments that arose, the court's reasoning, and even a dissenting perspective that challenges some fundamental aspects of the decision.
And we're drawing directly from the court's opinion, yeah.
Exactly. The opinion itself and some helpful analysis geared specifically towards law students.
Okay, so let's get into the nitty-gritty. Commonwealth v. Day. What exactly brought this case before the courts in the first place? What were the initial charges?
Well, the case stemmed from an incident back on April 24th, 1980, in Revere. The individual at the center, Dennis M. Day, was ultimately found guilty at trial of assault with intent to kill, which is actually a lesser charge than the original assault with intent to murder,
Oh, interesting.
along with assault by means of a dangerous weapon and unlawfully carrying a firearm. So, as you can see, quite serious allegations.
Definitely not minor offenses. And as is often the case, the trial wasn't the final word, was it? There were some appeals and further legal challenges.
Exactly. Following the conviction at the trial level, Day took his case to the Massachusetts Appeals Court. And interestingly, that court actually reversed the trial court's
Or
decision.
reversed it. Okay.
This reversal then prompted the Commonwealth to seek review by the highest court in the state, the Supreme Judicial Court, or the SJC. It's their decision in the Day case that we're really going to dissect today.
All right, so picture the scene. What unfolded that night in Revere? What's the factual story that led to all this legal back and forth?
Well, the incident involved a man leaving a local bar who then encountered two younger individuals who were engaged in some sort of wrestling on the sidewalk. According to the factual account presented in the SJC's opinion, a brief confrontation occurred between the man and these youths. Tragically, the man then drew a firearm and shot one of the young men in the abdomen at close range.
Wow, a violent encounter. Were there any particular details about what was said or observed at the scene that later became significant in the legal proceedings?
Yes, a couple of things stand out. Witnesses who were present reported hearing the gunman say a specific phrase just before he left the scene. He didn't listen.
She didn't listen.
Yeah. While seemingly a minor detail, it offers a small window into the assailant's state of mind. However, perhaps the most crucial aspect leading to the legal complexities of the case were the inconsistencies that emerged in how the witnesses identified the gunman as the case moved through the legal system.
Ah, the ever-present challenge of eyewitness testimony. So the crux of the issue was that what the witnesses said they saw and who they identified shifted over time.
Precisely. Some of the witnesses had identified Day as the gunman at an earlier stage, specifically when they gave their testimony before the grand
Oh,
jury.
before the grand jury.
Right. However, when these same individuals took the stand during the actual trial, their certainty seemed to, well, evaporate. Some became less sure of their identification, and in some instances, witnesses even completely retracted their earlier identification of Day.
Right, so the prosecution had these prior sworn statements from the grand jury identifying the defendant, but then those same witnesses seemed to backpedal during the trial itself. How did the prosecution try to use those earlier statements?
This is where the legal intricacies of the Day case really come into play. The prosecution made a significant strategic move. They attempted to use the prior grand jury testimony not merely to cast doubt on the witness's current trial testimony, which is a standard tactic known as impeachment.
Right, just questioning credibility.
Exactly. But to introduce those earlier statements as direct, substantive evidence of Day's guilt. They essentially argued that the jury should consider those prior identifications made under oath to the grand jury as if they were made live on the witness stand during the trial.
So the argument wasn't just this witness is now saying something different, so maybe they're not reliable, but rather what they said to the grand jury was actually the truth, and that should be considered as proof that Day committed these crimes.
Spot on.
That's a fundamental difference in how the evidence is viewed. What was the central legal question that the SJC had to address regarding this?
The primary legal question before the Supreme Judicial Court was exactly that. Could this prior grand jury testimony, where a witness identified the defendant, be admitted as substantive evidence of guilt, even though that same witness later contradicted that testimony during the trial? This really pitted traditional evidence rules against the prosecution's argument for the reliability of the earlier sworn testimony.
What was the established legal principle before this case? Was it generally accepted that prior inconsistent statements could be used in this direct way?
Traditionally, under the common law rules of evidence, prior inconsistent statements were generally admissible for a limited purpose, to impeach the credibility of a witness. Yeah. They could be used to show that a witness had given different accounts of the same events at different times, thereby raising questions about the reliability of their current testimony. However, these prior statements were not typically considered direct proof of the facts asserted within them.
So they couldn't stand on their own as proof?
Generally, no. Day marked a significant departure from this traditional view in Massachusetts, at least for specific types of prior statements made under particular circumstances.
Okay, so Day essentially created a new pathway for admitting this type of evidence. What are the specific conditions? What's the Day test that the SJC established for when prior grand jury testimony can be used as substantive evidence?
The SJC established a clear three-pronged test that must be met. First, the witness who made the prior statement to the grand jury must be available for what the court termed effective cross-examination during the trial.
Effective cross-examination?
Yeah, and importantly, this cross-examination needs to specifically address the prior statement itself, the circumstances under which it was given, and any reasons the witness might have for the current inconsistency.
Makes sense.
Second, it must be clearly established that the prior statement represents the witness's own words. It can't be the result of coercion or simply the witness agreeing with leading questions posed by the prosecutor during the grand jury. The statement should reflect the witness's independent recollection and narrative at that earlier time.
Okay, so witness available for cross-examination about the statement. It has to be their own words. What's the crucial third element of this test?
The third vital component is that the prosecution must present other independent corroborating evidence that lends credence to the truthfulness of the prior statement.
Corroborating evidence, like what?
Well, this could take various forms, such as forensic evidence like ballistics in a shooting case, maybe the testimony of other witnesses who independently corroborate the details of the prior statement, or even circumstantial evidence that aligns with what was said earlier.
That makes logical sense. The court is essentially saying, okay, we'll allow the jury to consider these earlier statements as proof, but only if the witness can be questioned about them now, if they were genuinely the witness's own account then, and if there's other evidence that backs up what was said.
Exactly.
What was the court's underlying rationale for making this significant change? Why did they believe that grand jury testimony warranted this special consideration?
Well, the court reasoned that grand jury testimony carries certain inherent indicia of reliability. For one, it is given under oath, which carries legal weight and the risk of perjury charges if the witness lies.
Right. The oath matters.
It does. Furthermore, grand jury testimony is typically provided much closer in time to the actual events being described. This temporal proximity often means that the witness's memory is likely to be fresher and less susceptible to the distortions of time, suggestion, or external influences compared to testimony given months or even years later at trial.
Good point. Memory fades.
Right. The court also emphasized that the opportunity for cross-examination at trial, even if it's focused on a past statement, still provides the defense with a chance to scrutinize the prior testimony and challenge its accuracy and veracity.
But they didn't just open the floodgates for all prior inconsistent statements, right? There were still important limitations on this new rule?
Absolutely. The SJC explicitly stated that a conviction cannot be based solely on uncorroborated prior inconsistent statements, that additional supporting evidence is a non-negotiable requirement.
Okay, that's crucial.
Yes. This prevents a situation where a defendant could be convicted based entirely on a statement that the witness now disavows in open court.
So let's circle back to Day's trial specifically. Mm-hmm. What did the SJC find when they applied this new framework to the prior statements in his case? Was the newly established Day test actually met at his trial?
Well, the SJC concluded that the trial judge had indeed made several errors in this regard. The judge had permitted some of the grand jury testimony to be admitted without properly ensuring that all the specific requirements of the newly articulated Day test had been satisfied. Moreover, the trial judge had failed to provide clear and appropriate limiting instructions to the jury, explaining the specific way in which they could and could not consider this prior inconsistent testimony.
Which leads us neatly to the second major issue in the case, the pre-trial photographic identifications. What exactly transpired with those?
Right. So before the trial commenced, witnesses had been presented with photographic lineups, often referred to as photo arrays, and some of these witnesses had identified Day's photograph as potentially being that of the gunman.
Okay, a standard procedure.
Yes, but here's the twist. When these same witnesses were called to testify during the trial, they were unable to make a definitive in-court identification of Day. In some instances, they couldn't even say for certain that the person they had picked out in the photo array was the defendant sitting in the courtroom.
So they couldn't make the ID in court.
Correct. Despite this lack of in-court confirmation, the police officers who had conducted the photo arrays were allowed to take the stand and testify about these out-of-court identifications that the witnesses had previously made.
So the police were essentially saying, hey, these witnesses picked him out earlier, even though they can't or won't do it now in court.
Hmm.
What was the SJC's ruling on this police testimony?
The Supreme Judicial Court decisively ruled that this testimony from the police officers regarding the pretrial photo identifications was inadmissible as evidence.
Inadmissible. Okay.
Yes. And they articulated several key reasons for this conclusion.
Let's delve into those reasons. Why did the court find this particular testimony to be improper?
Firstly, the court raised significant concerns about hearsay. The police officers were essentially recounting statements made by the witnesses outside of the courtroom, and critically, the defense had no opportunity to cross-examine the witnesses themselves about the circumstances surrounding the photo array identification, their level of certainty at the time they made the identification, or, you know, whether there might have been any suggestiveness in the way the photo array was presented.
Right, no chance to challenge the actual person who supposedly made the ID.
Exactly. Secondly, the court determined that the officer's testimony about the identification, without a confirming in-court identification from the witness, possessed significantly less probative value. The actual identification made by the eyewitness is the relevant piece of information, and the officer's secondhand account of that identification is a step removed and inherently less reliable.
Makes sense.
Finally, the court expressed concern about the potential for the jury to give undue weight to the testimony of law enforcement officers. Jurors might be inclined to place more trust in police testimony, potentially leading them to give excessive importance to these unconfirmed out-of-court identifications.
That makes sense. It's almost as if the prosecution was trying to, you know, sneak these prior identifications in through a less reliable source when the actual eyewitnesses couldn't or wouldn't stand by those identifications in court.
That's a fair way to put it.
So we've got issues with the prior inconsistent statements and the photo IDs. You also mentioned problems with the instructions given to the jury.
Yes. The third significant issue that the SJC addressed concerned the instructions that the trial judge provided to the jury.
Mm-hmm.
Or, perhaps more accurately, the instructions that the judge failed to provide adequately. Mm-hmm. As we discussed earlier, the prosecution had presented prior inconsistent statements. The SJC found that the trial judge did not sufficiently instruct the jury on the specific and limited purpose for which they could consider these prior statements, even under the newly established Day rule.
And why was this a critical failing? Why did the lack of these specific instructions constitute what's known as reversible error?
The court reasoned that without clear and specific guidance from the trial judge, the jury might have improperly treated the prior inconsistent statements as the primary and conclusive proof of Day's guilt.
Gotcha.
They might have done this even if the specific safeguards outlined in the Day test, such as verifying that the statement was truly the witness's own and that there was independent corroborating evidence, were not fully met. This lack of clear instructions left too much room for the jury to misunderstand and potentially misuse this type of evidence in their deliberations.
So, these cumulative errors, the improper handling of the prior inconsistent statements, the inadmissible police testimony regarding the photo IDs, and the inadequate jury instructions ultimately led the SJC to agree with the appeals court's decision to grant Day a new trial.
That's correct.
But there was another voice in this decision, wasn't there? Justice Liancos offered a different perspective on at least one of these key issues.
That's absolutely correct. Justice Liancos concurred with the majority's ultimate decision to grant Dennis Day a new trial, agreeing that the errors in the jury instructions were sufficiently significant to warrant a reversal of the original conviction.
Okay, so he agreed on the new trial part.
Yes, but he strongly disagreed with the majority's landmark decision to allow the substantive use of prior inconsistent grand jury testimony. He issued a dissenting opinion specifically addressing that pivotal point.
What were Justice Liancos' main objections to this new rule? What were his core arguments against allowing prior inconsistent grand jury testimony to be used as direct evidence?
Justice Liancos raised a fundamental concern regarding the defendant's Sixth Amendment right to confront and cross-examine the witnesses against them.
The Confrontation Clause.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He argued that the majority's newly established rule significantly weakened this crucial constitutional protection, particularly the ability of the defendant to confront and cross-examine a witness at the time they make an incriminating statement.
So his concern was that cross-examining a witness at trial about something they said much earlier in the very different setting of a grand jury proceeding wasn't a sufficient substitute for immediate confrontation.
Precisely. Justice Liancos emphasized the critical importance of what he termed timely cross-examination. He firmly believed that the opportunity to question a witness immediately after they make a statement, while their memory is fresh and under the same legal scrutiny, is far more effective and essential for testing the reliability and truthfulness of that statement compared to cross-examining them months or even years later about a prior inconsistent statement given in the, well, less adversarial environment of a grand jury.
Yeah, that makes sense. The context is totally different.
Right. He was concerned that the passage of time and the inherent differences between trial and grand jury proceedings could severely impede the defense's ability to effectively challenge the earlier testimony.
And beyond this core issue of the Confrontation Clause, did Justice Liancos express any other reservations about this new rule regarding prior inconsistent statements?
Yes, he also articulated concerns about the potential for wrongful convictions. He worried that allowing convictions to be based, even partially, on prior statements that the witness now contradicts in court, especially without the robust adversarial testing that occurs with contemporaneous cross-examination, could increase the risk of innocent individuals being wrongly found guilty.
A serious concern.
Definitely. Furthermore, he also pointed out that this significant shift in the rules of evidence was being implemented without extensive legal briefing and a thorough consideration of all the potential constitutional ramifications.
So a really fundamental disagreement at the highest court about the delicate balance between potentially reliable evidence and the defendant's constitutional rights. Now, for you, the law student who's listening to this, what are the absolute key takeaways from Commonwealth v. Day that you need to understand and remember as you continue your legal education?
Okay, there are several crucial points that should stick with you. Firstly, Day represents a really significant turning point in Massachusetts evidence law. It brought the state's approach to prior inconsistent statements much closer to the federal rules of evidence.
Right. You mentioned Tome v. U.S. earlier.
Exactly. That's a good connection point for further study. This means that in Massachusetts, under those very specific conditions we've discussed, prior statements can now be used not just to challenge a witness's credibility, but as actual substantive proof of the facts they assert.
So the focus shifts from just questioning if the witness is being truthful now to also considering whether they were being truthful then based on certain safeguards. What's another key concept to keep in mind?
Secondly, you absolutely must grasp both the power and the potential pitfalls of prior statements in legal proceedings. Understand that critical distinction between using a prior statement for impeachment simply to damage a witness's believability in the eyes of the jury versus using it substantively to actually prove a key fact in the case.
Impeachment versus substantive use. Got it.
Right. Day opens the door to the latter, but only when all those specific conditions of the Day test are strictly satisfied. As a future legal professional, whether you find yourself as a prosecutor trying to admit such a statement or as a defense attorney trying to exclude it, a thorough understanding of the Day test is absolutely essential.
And the third critical takeaway for our listener.
The absolutely vital role of corroboration. If the prosecution intends to use a prior inconsistent statement as substantive evidence under the Day rule, they have a mandatory obligation to present other independent evidence that supports the truthfulness of that prior statement.
Mandatory corroboration.
Yes. As a future prosecutor, Building that corroborating case will be paramount. Conversely, as a defense attorney, you'll need to critically examine the quality and the sufficiency of any corroboration offered. It's worth noting that the Day decision itself doesn't provide an exhaustive definition of exactly what constitutes sufficient corroborative evidence, which means this is an area ripe for legal argument and interpretation in future cases.
That's a really important nuance. The standard isn't perfectly defined. And finally, it's crucial not to overlook Justice Kliakos's dissenting opinion and the broader constitutional implications that he raised, correct?
Precisely. You need to be keenly aware of the ongoing tension between the Day rule and the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment to the United States Constitution. Consider how this ruling might intersect with later Supreme Court cases, particularly the landmark decision in Crawford v. Washington, which places a strong emphasis on the admissibility of testimonial statements and the right to cross-examine the individuals who made them.
Right, Crawford is huge.
It is. And understanding how Day fits into that evolving landscape is really crucial for your grasp of evidence law and constitutional rights.
So in this deep dive into Commonwealth v. Day, we've really unpacked a pivotal moment in Massachusetts evidence law. The SJC, while recognizing the potential reliability of sworn grand jury testimony, also established crucial safeguards aimed at protecting the rights of the accused.
Mm-hmm.
And as Justice Kliakos' dissent highlights, there remains an ongoing and important debate about how best to balance the pursuit of truth with the fundamental right to confront one's accusers.
Which raises a really important question for you to think about as you continue your legal studies.
Hmm.
In a legal system where human memory is fallible and external influences can impact recollection, does allowing the substantive use of prior statements ultimately serve the interests of justice? Or does it potentially create an avenue for unfairness if those carefully crafted safeguards aren't rigorously and consistently applied?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
It really is. And how might this Day ruling shape your strategic thinking as a future trial lawyer? Something to definitely mull over.
This deep dive is really just the starting point, though. To truly understand the lasting impact of Commonwealth v. Day, you should consider researching the subsequent case law that has interpreted and applied its rule in various factual scenarios.
Absolutely.
Also, explore the scholarly discussions and debates surrounding the use of prior inconsistent statements in criminal trials. A solid grasp of Day is undoubtedly a cornerstone of your legal education, not just in Massachusetts, but in understanding the broader principles of evidence law.